Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Today we will be continuing with the examination of the Sutta Nipata, and we're in what's called the great chapter, the Mahavagga. And today we come to the Sutta number 4 in the great chapter. This has actually two titles. One title is called the Purulasa Sutta. This means the discourse on the sacrificial cake, and it's also known by the name of the Sundarika Bharadvaja Sutta. That's the name of the Brahmin who is the protagonist in the sutta. And the starting point of this sutta is the ancient Brahmin practice of the sacrifice. In the time of the Buddha, the main practice in which the Brahmins engaged was that of offering sacrifices. And for the Brahmins, the sacrifice was offered up not so much an offering to a deity in the hope of winning the favor of a deity, but rather the sacrifice was seen as a means of maintaining or sustaining the cosmic order. The fire was considered a manifestation of the god Agni. Agni is the god of fire. And all the different deities of Brahmanism are just manifestations of the divine power of the universe. They're not so much really individual personal gods the way we might consider deities in the light of Western theism or even polytheism, but they're considered just different manifestations, different aspects of the divine power of the universe. And the practice of sacrifice is the way of sustaining and maintaining the divine order of the universe. The Brahmins consider themselves to be the priestly caste, those who were endowed or assigned the special task within the human society of performing sacrifices in order to maintain the divine order of the universe. And when the Brahmins perform the sacrifices correctly, in accordance with the instructions that come down in the sacred texts, the sacred texts are called the Vedas, then the universe will unfold in an orderly, harmonious way that contributes to human welfare. If the Brahmins do not fulfill the instructions for the correct performance of the sacrifice, this will lead to social chaos, disorder, and confusion, disharmony, even to cosmic disharmony and confusion. Okay, so within society, the Brahmins have the task of maintaining the order of the universe through the performance of sacrifice. And then within Indian society, there was another group of religious practitioners who had stepped outside of the entire social order in order to seek liberation release from the cosmic process into the state of nirvana, moksha, enlightenment. These were the samanas, the ascetics. And the Brahmins, because they were concerned with the preservation of cosmic order, cosmic harmony, did not have a favorable opinion of the ascetics. They generally regarded them as sometimes even lower than the outcasts. And so they would speak about them in a disparaging way. They would look upon them with contempt. And in this sutta, we're going to see a confrontation of a Brahmin, a very high caste Brahmin, with the Buddha, who is representing the samanas, the ascetics. Okay, so when the sutta opens, the Buddha is staying in the state of Kosala on the bank of the river called Sundarika. And there is a Brahmin living there whose name is Sundarika Bharadvaja. The Bharadvajas, this was a clan of Brahmins. It was a very, very high-ranking clan of Brahmins. Okay, and he was performing his rituals and performing a fire sacrifice. And when he performs a sacrifice, he offers various items to the fire. And I don't know the details of the sacrifice, but as a result of these rituals, a certain cake results. The offering results in a kind of cake forms as a result of the sacrifice. And the Brahmin is not supposed to eat the cake himself, but he is supposed to offer, according to the laws that have come down in the Vedas, he's supposed to offer that cake to another Brahmin. He cannot offer it to any other human being, but only to another Brahmin. So this Brahmin is wondering, who should I give the remains of my offering to? And then he notices, not far away, he sees the Buddha sitting under a tree, but the Buddha has covered his head with his robe like this. And so the Brahmin walks over to the Buddha, and when the Buddha hears the Brahmin's footsteps, then he removes his robe so that the Brahmin sees that the Buddha's head is shaved, and that is the mark, the sign of a samana, an ascetic. And when the Brahmin sees this, he says that this man has his head shaved. He uses the expression, first he says that this gentleman is mundo, which means simply that he has his head shaved. Then he says, mundiko ayang bhavang. Mundiko is a kind of disparaging term. Here it's translated shaveling. It's the kind of term that the Brahmins use to put down the ascetics. It's a disparaging word. And then the Brahmin turned around and he started to walk away. But then it occurred to him that also there are Brahmins who have their head shaved. So maybe I should go to him and ask him, what is his family? What is his clan, his gotra? And what is his caste? What is his birth? Okay, so the Brahmin comes up to him and he says, King Jacho Bhavang. It's translated, what caste are you? What is your birth? Okay, and even though this question, the way it's asked, it might seem to us that, okay, this is just a way of thinking that comes from ancient India. But we could actually transpose this to even to our modern way of thinking, and we could see this as representing the way when we want to relate to a person, we always are trying to find some little category to put him into, some way of finding a label to put, to apply to that person, to see whether that person will fit into a category that we will feel comfortable with, whether we can accept that person or reject that person. I come from a Jewish background, so when a Jewish person meets another person, let's say there are two Jewish people, they're introduced to another person, one will turn to the other and they'll ask, but is he Jewish? So often it's not necessary for them to ask, because Jewish people develop such a fine sensitivity that just by looking at a person, or even by the sound, the timbre of their voice, they can pick up whether or not the person is Jewish or not. In Sri Lanka, as Buddhist monks, when we meet another monk, we ask, where were you ordained? We want to find out what temple, what monastery he was ordained in. Is it a monastery that's acceptable to us? Ah, he's ordained in Kalduva. Okay, he's acceptable. That's a good monastery. This one's ordained in, okay, Maharagama. Okay, that's all right. That's acceptable. This one's ordained in maybe some little village temple we never heard of. So a little suspicious. We don't know what the background is of a place. Check it out. And even in India today, I mean, the caste system, though officially it's not legally recognized by the Constitution of India, but somebody wants to get married to a girl, the parents of the man will say, inquire, what is her caste? That's the major determinant of whether it's acceptable for their son to marry the girl, whether she's from an acceptable caste or not. Okay, so this is, through all of these centuries, the major way of determining the Indian way of thinking. Probably even in China, you have the Chinese community, same way of thinking, very similar way of thinking. What is the family name? What is family background? Right? Area. From Indonesia. Is it completely trustworthy? Overseas, yeah, yeah. Not pure Taiwan, not pure mainland. Okay, so the Brahmin asks, what caste are you? What is your birth? And now the Buddha was from Kshatriya class, which was very, very high ranking class. And if the Buddha wanted, and the Shakyan clan was very, very highly regarded clan, but the Buddha didn't say, I am a Kshatriya from the Shakyan clan. But the verse that he replies with, very beautiful verse, he says, I like the Pali, na brahmano nomhi na rajaputo na vesaya no uta kochinom hi gotang parinyaya putu jananang akinchano manta charami loke. He says, I am not a Brahmin, nor am I the son of the princes, son of a king. even though the Buddha's family is the family of kings or princes, the royalty, but the Buddha has given up the household life, so he doesn't consider himself to be any more Rajaputo, to be the son of princes. I am not from the merchant clan, he translated a farmer, nor am I anything else. The next line, not well translated, I have come to understand clearly how worldly people are born. Rather, the meaning is, I have come to understand that clan or family is a consideration of worldly people. That this is the way worldly people think in terms of classifying by way of clans. And then the last line, I wander through the world as a wise man, a kinchino, a man who is nothing, one who is nothing. He translates without possessions, with nothing. But I like to take it as one who is nothing. Usually in our society, in our culture, the object for a young man is to make something of yourself. Be something. Become someone when you grow up. But in the ancient Indian spiritual culture, the aim was to become a kinchino, one who is nothing, which means to become inwardly completely empty, completely transparent, without any points of attachment. It includes the sense of having no possessions, but probably at a deeper level, it has the sense of having no identification with anything, having no sense of being anyone or anything. And then he continues, Sangha divasi agiho charami nivutta keso abhi niputato alipamano idamanavehi akalamang brahmana puchikotang. Here I wander wearing this sangati, this robe which is made of pieces of cloth sewn together, just pieces of cast-off cloth that have been sewn together, without any home, any fixed residence. With my hair shaved off. And then he has fully calmed, but abhiniputato, with myself inwardly extinguished, you could say. You could say perfectly at peace, with my mind perfectly at peace. Unattached to anyone in the world. So this question about my caste is completely irrelevant. Okay, then the Brahmin tries to excuse himself by saying that when we Brahmins meet others, we always ask whether or not the other one is a Brahmin. Then there's a little exchange. I'm not completely clear about the meaning of the Buddha's reply here. He's referring to some meter of a certain mantra that the Brahmins use. I don't quite understand the relevance of that. Then the Brahmin asked the Buddha how one can make an offering to the devas in this world, a sacrifice, so that the sacrifice will be completely successful. Then the Buddha explains that the success of the sacrifice of the offering depends upon the qualities of the person who receives the offering. And he says, if the person who receives the offering is at the time of the offering one who has yadantagu vedaku yanyakale yasahuting labe tas ije ti brumi, if he has reached the end, reached a master of knowledge, one who has reached the end, then I say that that offering will be successful. Okay, so if the recipient of the offering is one who is perfect in understanding, one who is accomplished, then the offering will be successful. And now the Brahmin is starting to gain faith in the Buddha. Because now he says, this offering will certainly be successful then, for here in front of me is just such a man who is perfect in knowledge and understanding. Previously, I hadn't seen anyone like you before. That is why I was giving the sacrificial cake to other people. Then the Brahmin goes on to ask, now I'm in verse 7, he asks the Buddha, teach me and tell me what makes an offering effective. And then the Buddha says, listen carefully, Brahmin, and I'll teach you about it. Now I go on to verse 8, and it seems to me that verse 8 is still going on referring back to the original question of the Brahmin, where the Brahmin asked, what caste are you? What birth are you? Because here the Buddha refers back to caste, back to birth. And in fact, there's another version of the sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. And in that version of the sutta, when the Brahmin asks, what birth are you? What caste are you? The Buddha answers directly with this verse, verse number 8. And so the verses that come in between verses 1 to 7 here are not in the version found in the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, so here the Buddha is again referring to the question, what caste are you? What kind of birth are you? What is your family background? And here again the Buddha addresses that question and he says, I like this verse too, so I read in the Pali. Ma ja ting pu cha cha ra nan cha pu cha kat ta ha ve ja ya ti ja ta ve do ni cha ku li no pi mu ni ti ti ma a ja ni o ho ti hi ri Nise Do. This is really, in a way, if you understand Indian society at the time of the Buddha, even today, where this class mentality was so strongly established. Everybody is ranking everyone by way of class and caste. And particularly the Brahmins think that the possibility of purification is only for those, particularly only for Brahmins, but at most for those in the three upper classes, and those who are from the class of the Sudras, the working class, and the outcasts are completely excluded from any possibility of spiritual progress. And so now they're asking the Buddha, what class are you from? And the Buddha completely rejects this whole question of birth and class and says, don't be concerned with class at all. And he introduces this idea that's completely revolutionary for India at that time. Ask about conduct. And he says, a person from Nicha Kuli, somebody from a low class, low family, somebody who can be just a street sweeper, somebody who cleans up the garbage, a garbage collector, somebody who works in the cremation ground, can become a liberated, enlightened saint. That's possible. Somebody who even is a murderer can be transformed and become a saint. A woman who is a prostitute can become a liberated, enlightened saint. So the Buddha is not concerned with family, not concerned with background, but concerned with conduct. And then he uses this simile or analogy, which maybe it's somewhat obscure. In the translation, it's spelled out a little bit. Look at the flames of a fire. Where do they come from? From a piece of wood. The idea here is that if one takes a piece of wood from any kind of tree, it will give rise to a fire. One could take a piece of pine wood, it will give rise to fire. Piece of oak wood, it will give rise to fire. Piece of maple wood, it will give rise to fire. Piece of birch wood, it will give rise to fire. It doesn't matter what kind of wood one starts with, but every piece of wood has the nature of wood. When you light it with heat, when you apply enough heat to it, then it will catch flame and start to burn. Similarly, every human being has the nature of wisdom, the nature to become enlightened. It all depends upon the person's conduct, not upon what class or background that person comes from. But now the Buddha is going to spell out what are the qualities of the person who is worthy to receive the sacrificial offering. So now he'll go on. It's so nice in the Pali, the verses, when you put it into translation, they just become rather flat. I'll just take a few of these verses from the Pali. I won't try to go through the whole thing. And then we'll go to the end. Satchena danto dhamma sa upeto Vedanta guvusita brahmachario kalena tam hi havayam paveche yo brahmano punya peko yajeta. Okay, now the Buddha is speaking about this one from the low family, person who might be from a low family, but who becomes, through his conduct, through his wisdom, he becomes a sage. This person is tamed through truth and becomes endowed, possessed of training or taming with self-control. Then he uses this expression. In the translation here, it says, he comes to complete understanding. But in the Pali, it's Vedanta Gu, which means he reaches the end of the Vedas. He reaches the goal of the Vedas. Now the Vedas, these were the ancient scriptures of the Brahmins, which in the view of the Brahmins, only the Brahmins could study the Vedas. And the goal of the Vedas, that is reserved for the Brahmins themselves. But the Buddha is now saying that a person from a low family who trains according to not the Brahmin's path, but who trains according to the spiritual life, the holy life taught by the Buddha, that is the path of moral discipline, of meditation, of wisdom, reaches liberation. And by doing so, this person can be described as one who has come to the true final goal of the Vedas. And the Buddha says, this person, at the right time, you should make the offerings to him. This is where the Brahmin, who is intent on positive action, who is seeking merit, should make an offering. So this is, in a sense, the Buddha is turning the class system, the caste system, upside down. He's saying that now the Brahmin, the one who is at the top of the class system, should make an offering to this man of low family who has lived the holy life and reached the highest goal. Because the class divisions are unimportant. When a person lives and practices correctly and reaches the highest wisdom, then he is worthy of offerings from the Brahmins. Then the Buddha goes on, those who wander about without any homes, who have abandoned sense pleasures, who are well restrained within themselves, and who are straight as a shuttle, in good time, at the right time, one should make offerings to them. That is the one to whom the Brahmin, intent on or seeking merit, should make offerings. Then he goes on to describe this one as one who is free from lust, who has well-composed faculties, and who is just like the moon freed from the grip of Rahu. That is the moon freed from the clouds. Then he describes this one in various other ways. then in verse 13, now the Buddha is going to describe himself as being the one who's supremely worthy of offerings. So he starts off by saying, the wandering conqueror who has let go of sense pleasures, who has seen the end of birth and death, who is fully extinguished, who is cool like a lake, the Tathagata, he is the one who is worthy of offerings. Okay, then the Buddha goes on describing himself in various ways which highlight the kinds of characteristics that are considered, you might call these, the ideal characteristics of the liberated person in early Buddhism. Again and again, what's emphasized in different ways is the elimination of grasping, of craving, the perfection of knowledge, the rooting out of all of the passions and attachments, the breaking of all the ties and bonds, and freedom from bondage to the round of birth and death. And at the end of these verses, the last verse in the series, is verse 24. One for whom there is no inner delusion, the one who has knowledge and vision in regard to all phenomena, the one who bears his final body and who has attained the unsurpassed, peaceful, supreme enlightenment, the one whose spirit has reached purification, the Tathagata, is the one who deserves this offering of the sacrificial cake. Okay, when the Buddha finishes this verse, then the Brahmin is very joyful. And now the Brahmin's mind has been opened up with faith and confidence. And the Brahmin says, now I have met somebody who is complete in understanding, and my offering will be true. And he says, he calls Brahma to be my witness. And he says, let the Buddha accept my offering. May the Blessed One enjoy these offerings. But now comes a surprise. The Buddha won't accept the offering now. Now the Buddha recites certain verses. He says, Gata bhikkhitaṃ meya bhojaneyaṃ sampassataṃ brahmana nesa dhammo Gata bhikkhitaṃ panudanti buddha Dhamme sati brahmana vutiresa. He says, Brahman, I do not accept food earned by chanting texts. This is not the way for those who have clear vision, for those who see. The Buddhas reject what is earned by chanting verses. while the Dhamma exists, this is their practice. And it's somewhat puzzling, these verses. I try to understand why the Buddha won't accept this offering now. I think the sense is that maybe because the Buddha had to use some persuasion to convince the Brahmin, because the Brahmin was originally reluctant to make that offering of food to the Buddha. And so the Buddha had to explain that he was actually worthy to receive offerings of food. And since the Brahmin originally held back from making that offering of food, now the Buddha didn't want to receive it. The Buddha did not want to receive it after the Brahmin originally held back from making the offering. If the Brahmin originally went ahead with the offering, and then the Buddha had recited some verses by way of blessing, then of course the Buddha would have accepted the offering. But because the Buddha recited verses in order to show, to demonstrate to the Brahmin that he was a true field of offering, he didn't want to accept this particular sacrificial cake that the Brahmin originally held back from him. That is the way I would understand it. But the Buddha doesn't want to withhold from the Brahmin the opportunity to make merit by making an offering to him. So now in the next verse, the Buddha says to the Brahmin, "You can attend upon the great sage," that he's referring to himself, "the perfect one who is free of passion, who is calm in mind. Serve him with other food and drink. That will be a field of merit for one, that will be the field for one intent on merit." Okay, and so the Brahmin now says, "Very good, blessed one." And then the Brahmin asks, "I should like to know to whom people like me should offer merits. Tell me in the light of your teaching whom I should look for when I am making sacrifices." Then the Buddha explains some of the other qualities of a person to whom one should make offerings. The one who is free from quarrelsomeness, whose mind is undisturbed, who is free from lust for sense pleasures, who is without lethargy, whose passions have been conquered, who has understood the nature of birth and death, the one who is endowed with wisdom. This is the person to whom one should make offerings. Okay, then the Brahmin, again he applauds the Buddha, expresses his appreciation of the Buddha, and then the Brahmin praises the Buddha's teaching. He takes the refuge in the triple gem, and then he asked the Buddha for permission to leave the household life and to take ordination as a monk under the Buddha. And then we read that this Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja received ordination first as a novice and then the higher ordination under the Buddha, and then leading a secluded life, diligently, energetically, with resolute will, In a short time he understood, experienced, and attained that highest perfection of noble life for which the sons of good families leave the household life harmoniously and take to the life of homelessness. And he said, and he understood rebirth has been ended, the noble life has been led, what had to be done has been done, and there is nothing else to be done in this earthly existence. And Sundarika Bharadvaja had become one of the arahants. Okay, that is the Sundarika Bharadvaja Sutta. Okay, thank you all for your attention. And may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. On your own, you can go through more leisurely the verses that expound in detail the qualities of the sage who is worthy of offerings. They don't have to be explained each verse one by one. Okay, the verse, the blackboard was erased. The next sutta that we'll take is called the Sabaya Sutta. It's number 6. I'll do that next week. I think that probably has to be divided over about 2 weeks. Okay, so we end by sharing the merits. We think of the Devas, the Nagas, the Buddhas, and we share the merits with them, asking them to protect the true Dhamma, to protect all those who were trying to lead the virtuous life in the Dhamma, and ask them to preserve this world from harm and suffering. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.